Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have an international best-selling author. His name is Peter James, and he's written a new book. It's the sixth in a series of mysteries called Dead Like You. Hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. It's great to be here. And
how do you like all this cold weather we have on the East Coast?
Well, you know, it's dry. You know, in England, when it's like this, it's kind of usually kind of damp and rainy and foggy. At least here, it's kind of dry, and it feels incredibly Christmassy.
Yeah, it's like 20 degrees where I am in Pennsylvania. I'm like,
you could kill somebody here, and they'd stay intact for days without starting to smell, you know.
What I'm surprised at is that before I saw this book come into the bookstore that I work at, I had never heard of you before. I must admit that. Why is it in the United States that I've never heard of you?
I've had a kind of checkered publishing history here. Unfortunately, when I started writing the Roy Gray series, we were published by a relatively small publisher called Carroll and Graf, and they were in financial trouble shortly after publishing my first book, and then they went bust and got taken over, and I sort of fell into a crevasse. So it's only now with St. Martin's Minotaur that I'm getting properly published here.
Oh, I see. That's why I haven't seen you before.
Yeah, America's like the sort of black hole in my kind of pub, because I'm published in 34 languages in 42 countries, but America's been the one kind of black hole in my publishing career. So hopefully that's going to get rectified now.
So you're a best-selling author in England.
Yeah, I mean, Dead Like You was number one in both hardcover and in paperback this year.
It's weird hearing you talk about paperback. We won't get a paperback here until next year probably for the book.
Yeah, I think next October, I think. But no, I mean, it's thanks to support of lovely people like you that hopefully I'll get a bit better known in America in the coming years.
Well, I have to admit, I'm just getting to the end part of the book, and it's riveting. It really is one of those books that I'm going to have to read before I go to sleep tonight, or it's going to bug me all night. You know, I have to know how it ends. And that's exactly how I feel. You write very smoothly. I really enjoy your sentences.
Thanks. I kind of tend to write the way that I like to read. I tend to read a lot sort of late night before I go to sleep, and so I like short chapters because I always like the idea that I could maybe finish a chapter before I go to sleep. So I tend to, when I'm writing, I kind of write the way that I would want to read a book.
Right. So you're considering the writer as the way you're writing. Excuse me. You're considering the reader as the way you're writing.
Yeah, I think it's really important to do that. I think that if you think about how somebody's going to read a book, it does actually help to inform the way you write.
Now, I'm looking at the front cover of this book. I'm wondering, is this a place in England? It almost looks like the top of a roller coaster to me or something. It's really strange. It's an interesting cover.
Yeah, all the Roy Grace novels are set in and around my home city of Brighton. And Brighton is a seaside city in England that began as a kind of seaside resort and grew into quite a substantial city, which it is today. But it's got a very distinct and idiosyncratic history to it, and a very idiosyncratic present to it, in that it's for long had this sobriquet of the crime capital of England.
Is that right?
And the murder capital of Europe.
So what a great place to pick for your novels, for your mysteries.
When I was a kid, the one of the most seminal novels I read was Graham Greene's Brighton Rock.
Ah.
And that was set in Brighton in 1937 and dealt with the whole kind of criminal undertow of the place then. And Brighton has got it's a very strange place because it has an almost perfect criminal environment. If you were going to design a city that was going to be a criminal environment, you could not do better than Brighton. It has a reputation that the past three chief police constables have all told me of being the favored place to live in the United Kingdom for First Division criminals. And part of the reason is it has a major seaport on both sides of it, so to the east and to the west. So it's perfect for bringing in drugs. It's perfect for exporting stolen antiques.
Pretty easily, I guess.
Yeah. It's got miles of unguarded coastland. It has an airport that has no customs and no immigration control.
Now, you've lived there, or you've just visited many times there?
I was born there.
Oh, you were born there? Wow.
And grew up. So I was kind of born and raised. And there were, when I was a kind of teenage growing up, there were these gangs that you used to sort of hear the names of and you'd steer clear of. There was a particular family called the Weavers and another called the Ransoms. And if you went into a bar when I was a kid and you saw one of these people in that, like, you'd get up because you'd know sooner or later that place was going to kick off.
Hmm.
And part of what its allure is, it's got the largest number of antique shops in the UK. So it's a great place to get rid of stolen goods. It's got two universities and it's got a massive young kind of hip community. So it's a very big recreational drugs market.
So it's a great place to have a serial rapist.
It's a terrific place.
Which is very interesting, and there's not a lot of mysteries today that have serial rapists in them. That's kind of unusual. Why did you pick that? And you know, what about that? I mean, did you do some research into it?
Yeah, one of the things that really interests me, I in all the crime novels that I write, I try to be as close to reality as possible. And there's one very big common denominator between a lot of the greatest, if you say, I say greatest, I don't mean that in a nice sense, but in a nasty sense, between some of the greatest criminals in the last 50 years, in that so many of them are such outwardly respectable people. You know, if you like, take Ted Bundy here in America.
Right.
Who's probably the nastiest serial murder and rapist that you've had over here.
But he could be the nicest guy to some people. I mean, you ask some people and they'll say...
guy, he was a lawyer for the Republican Party.
He had everybody fooled.
The worst criminal we've had in England in the last decade was a guy called Harold Shipman, who was a nice, bearded, bespectacled, 55-year-old family doctor who just happened to have a penchant for killing his patients and killed 350 of them.
What?
Yeah.
That's unspeakable.
It's unspeakable. And, you know,
why? Why would you kill 350 people? I mean, that's a major...
like doing it.
Wow.
He wasn't motivated particularly by money or anything. It was just like power.
So he got nothing from killing these people other than the sheer joy of killing them.
Just the sheer joy. And things like that fascinate me because it's, you know, what separates you and I from something like that. And I was at a police... I go out with the police a lot. I spend, on average over the year, a day a week out with the police, mostly in England and in and around Brighton, but quite often in the US too. I go out, particularly I have some friends in the NYPD, so I go out here a lot and in other police forces, particularly in Europe. But 5 years ago, I was at a lecture in San Francisco given by a senior investigating officer on this particularly nasty rape case in England. And it was a guy in the north of England, in South Yorkshire, who between 1983 and 1987 attacked and raped a series of women late night. He'd choose victims very carefully. He selected victims on the basis of their shoes. Always people with sexy stiletto-heeled shoes. He'd attack them late night outside bars and pubs. He'd drag them into an alleyway. He'd tie them up. He'd rape them, and then he'd take their shoes. And suddenly, in 1987, he stopped. And the trail went cold, and the police lost everything. And 16 years later, by chance, they arrested this woman for drunken driving. And as it is standard, they took a DNA swab of her mouth, and they got what's called a familial match with the rapist. It means it's a close enough that it's a family member.
Wow.
And they went around to see her about 3 weeks later, and they said, you know, do you have a brother? And she said, well, yes, I do, but he's a very respectable businessman. And he was.
Like, that means anything, you know?
Yeah, like...
So is Donald Trump, right?
But Mr. Madoff.
Right.
You know, this guy's name was James Lloyd. He was the manager of a huge printing works. He was a Freemason. He was married, happily married, apparently, and he had two kids who adored him. And his sister phoned him up, and she said, I've just had a very strange conversation with the police. And his reaction was to try to hang himself in his garage that night.
Wow.
And he didn't succeed, and in fact, his son cut him down. And the next day, the police raided his office, and they lifted the carpet under his desk, and they found a trap door. And under that trap door, they found 126 pairs of stiletto-heeled shoes, each beautifully and carefully wrapped in cellophane.
Hmm.
And the guy's now doing a life sentence.
Wow. What would he want with the shoes? That's very strange. And that's what is central to this novel, too, a guy who's very much into shoes. But you don't wonder
what... I always try to, when I write, I'm always interested in... I want to tell a good story, but at the same time, I want my readers to understand, in the way that I want to understand, everything that's going on in the minds of all the main characters. So I try to write always from three perspectives. One from the perspective of the victim, one from the perspective of the police, and equally important to me, the perspective of the perpetrator. And I got fascinated, you know, why would somebody actually want to rape and then take their shoes? And I talked to a number of psychologists who've been involved in cases of this kind, and got a... There's no one answer. One of the eminent psychologists said to me, it's often you'll get a case of somebody who maybe was abandoned by his mother as a young kid, and the last noise he'd hear would be her stiletto heels clicking away as she went off to see a lover or whatever she was doing. So by taking the shoes, it means she can't leave him.
Oh, interesting.
Or another whose mother would maybe spank him with a shoe. So by taking the shoes, mm-hmm. she can't hurt him anymore. There's a kind of raft of different reasons. One of the interesting ones was I spent some time with the police rape prevention team, and I said, you know, what is this particular kind of penchant with taking trophies? And a police psychologist said to me, well, very often you get one of the breeds of people who becomes rapist. I mean, there's no one, you can't say there's one particular genre of person who becomes a rapist. You can't say it's a bookseller or a radio broadcaster or a lawyer. But one of them, the stereotypes, is the common house burglar, and he goes into houses, and then one day he goes into a woman's bedroom, and he gets aroused by the smell of the perfume, and he starts riffling around in her underwear, and then maybe she comes home, and she kind of attacks him, and he runs off, and he thinks, okay, next time I do a house, I'm going to get that woman. And it's not so much a sexual thing, it's more a kind of power thing.
Hmm.
And I asked the governor of one of the big prisons in England, which happens to be near me, if he had a career housebreaker that I could go talk to. And he produced this guy, and I went to see this guy, and this guy had 170 previous convictions for housebreaking. He was 42 years old, but he looked 60. This prison ages people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I said, you know, what... He was telling me his kind of career and how he started. I said, what's the bang for you in this? Why do you do this? And he said, it's quite exciting going in these places that, it's like a sort of, you've got this thrill of danger and you don't know if you're going to get caught and you don't know what you're going to find. And it was just bizarre. He had no moral code about it. It was just like, it was a game to him.
That's absolutely fascinating. So it begs the question of why you enjoy writing. What would you say if I asked you why you enjoy writing so much? I mean, writing's hard work.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, it's not a walk in the park.
No, I guess the part I enjoy most about writing is the research. I've always been fascinated in why we're here, why we do the things that we do.
Well, do you ever get so caught up in research you forget to write the book? or delay it a little bit?
I think maybe, you know, if I had the chance of sort of choice between spending a day in a cop car chasing villains up and down a highway or writing a novel, I know which I'd take. But, no, I love writing because it gives me the chance to explore human nature. And that's what I really love. I mean, you know, I've always been fascinated by why we do the things that we do.
And we see, and the villains in this book, I mean, we see inside their minds, which is really nice. We get to see what motivates them, or what they're thinking about, what excites them. And it makes the book even more interesting, because we get to see that inside it. You know, we get a first-hand. I mean, when you read a mystery, you read a thriller, you want to know what motivates these people to do these things. I mean, if it's not explained thoroughly at the end, you feel kind of cheated.
Thanks. I completely agree, and I think the books that I've always loved most in my life are the ones where you do understand the perspective of the perpetrator as much as that of the victim, and as much as the police are investigating it. And I think that one of the reasons that I love the mystery genre and the crime genre is that I think that it's the police are the glue that basically holds civilization together.
Mm-hmm.
And any cop in his career and is going to see almost every single aspect of the human condition. You know, I find it fascinating going out with the police, and one of the most common things that police get called to are what they call Wilmington domestics, which is a fight, basically, between a husband and wife, or
mm-hmm.
a guy and a girlfriend, and you go in someone's house, and they don't have to be low income, it can be middle income, it can even be high income, but the conditions in which so many people live are quite extraordinary. I was in a what they call a shout recently, which is a 9 emergency call. And we went to this house in Brighton, and it wasn't a particularly dull marketplace. And we go in, and there were conditions of utter squalor. There were McDonald's cartons lying on the floor with fungus on them.
Mm, wow.
Children's nappies soiled, lying on the carpet. 50-inch plasma TV screen on the wall.
How do people live like that? I just can't even imagine.
Yeah. And you had your feet stuck to the carpet as you walked across it. And I remember these two cops, and, you know, they calmed it all down, and they said to the woman, they said, you know, would you like us to take the guy away? And she says, no, we're all okay, sort it out. And we walked back, you know, our feet are still sticking to the carpet as we leave. And this cop turned to me and said, it's the kind of place you have to wipe your feet on the way out.
Wow.
And you do, you think, how on earth does any human being live like that? These aren't uneducated people.
And you think you've heard everything, but I was listening to the radio the other day, and there was a disturbance between a husband and a wife, and apparently she bit her husband's tongue out. I mean, you talk about horrific.
Like, God.
And you think, how in the world could you bite somebody's tongue out? That's a pretty hefty bite. And just the thought of it, you feel this intense pain, you know. And there's no end to what people will do to other people. I mean, you think you've seen it all, you think you've heard it all, and you haven't even heard anything close to it all. I mean, there's so much that goes on.
Yeah, particularly I think behind the closed doors of private lives.
So is your
and that's one of the things that the work that the police it's fascinating about the police. I remember talking to a cop years ago, and I said, why did you go to the police force? I like that idea, just go to people's houses and see how they were living.
Mm. They certainly don't do it for the money.
No.
Nobody becomes a police officer for the money.
not money, but it's like I had a lovely, back in a few months back in July, I was out in Brooklyn. I'm researching the next book I'm writing, which has a mafia involvement. And I was with this lovely NYPD cop, and he was 54 years old. Now, in England, most police are retired by the age of 50 because the pension scheme works that way, and it doesn't pay them to stay on.
Really? How interesting.
It's crazy. It's a mad system. It was brought in by Maggie Thatcher to encourage recruiting.
Right.
But basically, if they stay on after 30 years, it actually they lose money off the pension.
Wow.
I mean, it's crazy because they get to 49, they're at the peak of their career, peak of their fitness, and they leave and they go become security guards or something.
Well, they have to make a little extra money. You can't live on just your pension. I mean, who can live on just a pension?
Right. But I'm with this NYPD cop called Pat Lanigan, and he works now for the district attorney's office, and he spent the last 35 years of his career busting the mafia. I said to him, you're 54, I said, Ian, are you planning to retire anytime soon? And he pulled out his shield and he held it up and he said, Peter, he said, that is a ticket to a front row seat on the best show on earth.
Huh.
And I loved that. I thought that was so, kind of, so true.
You know, how interesting.
Police are not well paid, but you very rarely meet a cop who doesn't passionately love what he does.
One would think from reading your books that you yourself have an exciting life. You're so good at telling exciting stories. You know what? You must have an exciting life.
Yeah, I do love being. I mean, I find getting out with the police the most incredible adrenaline ride you can have. Particularly when something exciting happens, like you go on a raid or something, but it never happens. What I do love is the fact that things when you go out with the police never actually happen the way that, if you like, they're portrayed normally on television or in books. It never happens that way. I was a few months ago, I was spending a day with what's called the duty inspector at Brighton, and which means he's on a 12-hour shift, and anything of a major nature that happens during his watch, he has to take charge of. And I just arrived at 7 in the morning, so we've just had a tip-off. There's a 5 times wanted armed robber in this apartment, and we're going to go and arrest him. Do you want to come with us? And 5 times wanted means he's got 5 convictions for armed robbery. I said, yeah, you bet, love to. And he said, keep clear of the door when we go in case the guy shoots.
Wow.
I said, sure, okay. I said, I'll be wearing, you know, body armor. He said, no, we're going plain clothes because he can see out of his windows. So we don't want him to see anything bulky, so we're just going completely plain clothes, no armor, just keep clear.
Isn't that pretty dangerous?
So I'm thinking, do I want to do this? I thought, yeah. Okay. So he spends the next 2 hours on the phone and radio, and he's organizing his team. And then we drive along into Brighton, and we get out of his car, and we walk down the street, and every 50 meters down the street, there's a guy standing in a beanie and ripped jeans with an earpiece, one of his kind of team.
Right.
And we get down to the bottom, there's this old apartment, like a sort of 6-story low-rise, and the dog units turn up, and there's 2 lots of dog handlers go out to cover the side and back entrances. And then the what's called the local support team, which is the heavy guys who wear body armor, all kind of piled out of this truck. And I know that lot, and they looked at me and they said, oh, are you coming in with us? And I said, uh-huh. They said, keep clear of the door in case the guy shoots.
Hmm.
I said, thanks, that's twice. And then they had to get in the apartment without alerting him. So they rang all the different entry phone buttons except for his. And all these little old ladies were going, yes, hello.
Hmm.
One that said, FedEx, we have a package. So somebody clicked the door and we go in and we go up these 2 flights of stairs along the corridor. And I'm keeping well at the back. And one of them kind of kneels down. One of them rings the doorbell. There's no answer. Then one shouts through the letterbox, oh, Mr. Johnson, are you in? There's a sort of silence. And then they bash the door in with the battering ram.
Hmm.
And this guy, and he's about 6'2", jumps out and he bites one on the nose, jams his fingers in the eyes of another one.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and they rustle him, they get him face down on the ground, they handcuff him and they put these leg cuffs on, called a viper. And he goes, "You bastards," he said, "I hope you fix my bloody door." He says, "Last time you did this, I got burgled afterwards."
Wow.
And then a little old lady comes out of the apartment opposite and she says, "What the fuck's this noise?" And the inspector says, "Madam, would you get back in your apartment, please? We have a police raid here." "Hey, police, I will not get back in my apartment. I phoned you last week because my cat was missing and nobody's been in contact with me."
Oh my goodness. But it never ceases to amaze you what yeah. people will say in these situations. No respect for the police at all.
None.
Respect goes all out the window.
Yeah, yeah,
I mean, we really
I love that.
Unless you're a policeman yourself, you really can't appreciate what the police go through. What
right.
I mean, how they take their life into their hands when they do this job. And it's not a job for
that's very true, Dave. I think that almost every police officer, one of the first questions when I meet a new cop is that I like to ask them, is I say, has your life ever been in danger? And almost every police officer you ever meet, at some point in their career, they had their life on the line. They might not have realized it at the time, but thinking about it afterwards. But yeah, and I've been pretty scared a few times. I've you know, been at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, walking up to a car with a cop who's single crewed in some deserted car park, and the guy's meant to be there because he's an armed robber on the run or whatever. And you think, what am I doing here? I had a situation a few months back now with a young, quite a young sergeant, quite naive, and he probably only about 26, just been made a sergeant, and he had a young Indian policewoman with him, and she'd literally just qualified about 3 days earlier from being what they call a probationer. And we were in this very rough estate in the north of Brighton, and there's a bylaw in Brighton where you're not allowed to drink on the streets. You cannot have an open bottle or an open can. And it was 10 o'clock at night, on Thursday night. There were these 10 guys, all quite drunk, all walking down the street carrying open bottles and cans. So we pull over and they got out, and you know, I was wearing a yellow kind of police jacket, and I got out and I was standing behind them with my notebook as usual. And they confront these guys and it starts turning really ugly, and the guys were shouting racist taunts at the Indian policewoman.
Oh.
And they were telling the sergeant, you know, "You're not going to take these bottles off us, mate. You know, you want to take them off, you're going to fucking fight us."
Right.
And he was radioing for backup. But yeah, backup could take 25-30 minutes in that location at that time of night.
It's not like on TV where they're there in 2 minutes, you know.
No. Like, you know, we're on our own. And I'm thinking, do I get back in the car or do I run or do I stay and help my friends? And I thought, you know, the only way I'm going to maintain respect is I have to stay here and get involved. And I used to box when I was a kid, so I'm thinking, you know, do I sort of pick the smallest in the group and slug him? And suddenly one of the guys turned to me and said, "Who the fuck's he?" And they were all looking at me, and the sergeant, quick as a flash, said, "He's with the FBI. And there was a silence, and they all backed off. It became like pussycats. They handed over the bottles, handed over the cans. I was standing there thinking, yeah, respect.
Are all of your books based on things that actually happened? It sounds to me like they're like you was based on that, what the story you were telling me. But I mean, are they all based on some real life incident that happened?
They're all either based on a real life incident or not all of them, but most of them are based on something that's happened or some true story that I've been told by the cops.
Your
story, Grace, which was dead simple, was not so much based on something, but it was based on something that I thought could happen, like a wedding night prank that goes wrong. But the second one, Looking Good Dead, was based on the reality of snuff movies. And Dead Man's Footstep, which is about a guy who fakes his disappearance in 9/11.
Now, are all these going to be available in the States?
Yes, they are. They're all available on Amazon right now, and my American publishers are going to be republishing, I think, the whole backlist.
St. Martin's Minotaur will do that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great news. Because they're a great company. In fact, this book from St. Martin's is one of the longest mysteries that I've ever seen with St. Martin's. It's a pretty hefty book, but it's totally riveting from beginning to end.
Thank you.
So, I mean, but is that unusual to have a 500-page mystery?
Yeah, it's the longest that I've written, and the next one I've written is shorter. But this book kind of needed it because I had two time frames in it.
Well, how much into the book do you know it's going to be 500 pages? I mean, do you know right away it's going to be that long, or does it evolve over time, and then you realize?
To some extent, I plan in advance, but with this book, I hadn't anticipated it being that long. But it was when I got about a third of the way into the book, and I realized that if I was going to make these two time frames work, then I had to go into a fair amount of detail in both. So it ended up, in a sense, taking on its own life. That's what I love. I think spontaneity in writing. I plan a lot, but I think that you can always tell, I think, when you're reading a book, if the author is, if you like, using his hand in a kind of clunky way, or if the book's got that sort of slightly magic life.
What I really like are the scenes between Cleo and Roy. Cleo's his wife, his second wife, actually. For some reason, those scenes really are fun to read because they talk back and forth, and you know, you get the sense of them being a married couple and what, you know, they know each other pretty well, and you sense the love that's there, and of course he's haunted by his first wife, whose body was never found.
No, it still doesn't.
Now, I don't know.
There's a big shock coming with her in the next book, in fact.
Of the first wife?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I didn't know if anything was revealed in Dead Like You at the end, because I haven't gotten to the end yet, but I didn't want to give it away for anybody in case, but that is...
Yeah, no.
So has that happened since the beginning of the series, that his wife has been missing?
Yeah, when I was asked, by Macmillan, which is the UK sister company of St. Martin's Minotaur, about 9 years ago, if I'd be interested to create a new detective character. And it was something I always wanted to do. I was weaned on detective novels. I grew up on Sherlock Holmes and Christie and that whole kind of genre.
Right.
But when I started thinking about it, I thought, you know, a lot of the detectives, particularly in modern fiction today, follow this kind of mold. They have a broken marriage, and they have a drink problem. And before I wrote the Roy Glaze series, I'd been writing conventional thrillers. And for the last 15 years, I've spent an average of a day a week out with the police. And any cop who had a drink problem wouldn't last 10 seconds in the modern police force. They'd just be out of a job.
Right.
It wouldn't happen. You're not going to survive if you have a drink problem. And I thought, well, what would create a detective who was completely different to everything else in fiction? And I thought really hard about it. And I thought, you know, what good detectives do is they solve puzzles. That's really what every major crime is, every major homicide, every serial rapist, every serial killer. It's a puzzle. And I thought it would be really interesting to have a detective who had a private puzzle of his own that he could not solve. So the first time we meet Roy Glaze in Dead Simple, he's coming up to his 39th birthday. And we learned that 9 years earlier, on his 30th birthday, he came home and was going to go out to dinner with his wife, Sandy, who he loved and adored, and she wasn't there. And from that point onwards, he's never seen or heard from her again. And for 9 years, he's been looking for her. He doesn't know whether she's dead, you know, whether she got murdered, whether she got abducted. to...
So we're in for a real shock on the next book about her.
Yeah.
Oh, now I can't wait to read the next book. You shouldn't tease me like that. I have to wait a year for it now.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
But that's one of the drawbacks of being of liking a series so much. I mean, I just recently read a series of books by Brian Grewley, and you know, you read the second one, and all of a sudden at the end, you feel this loss, like I'm not going to be able to read another one for another year, and you really want that next one right then and there.
That's thank you for saying that. I mean, that's very nice, but and I agree with you. I think that. It's a difficult thing that because I hate to leave a reader feeling kind of unsatisfied, but at the same time, I think that as a writer, it's lovely to return to the same set of characters. You know, I've finished the next book, and a few months later, I start writing the one after, and it's fun to think, hey, here's you know. Glenn Branson, and here's Norman Potting, and here's all these other characters, and what have they been doing these last few months, and catching up with their lives. It's like going back to old friends.
And Norman's quite a guy. You gotta love Norman. He's crazy, but he's crazy. He knows what he's doing, but he's a little nuts.
He's my favorite character. He's a good detective, but he's completely politically incorrect. You know, he's kind of racist, he's homophobic, he's everything the police force has tried to get rid of in the last 20 years.
Now, of course, they probably can't get rid of them.
No, I get an email every week from a cop somewhere in the UK saying, we have Norman Potting in our office. You boasted some of him, didn't you?
Wow.
I take that as a great compliment.
It is. What I wonder, when you were saying things earlier, about the work schedule of a typical cop, do they really work these ridiculously... long hours? I mean, do they really do that in real life, or is that just done for the effect of the novel?
No, I mean, I think you've got to kind of when you break down the police force, you have, if you like, the regular uniformed police officers, and they work shifts, and you have you know, detectives. So again, some of whom work shifts, but if you are the senior investigating officer and you have a major crime takes place, say a homicide, the first few weeks of that investigation are literally full on 24/7.
How do they function on not getting any sleep?
Oh, they got sleep because you know quite often the senior investigating officer will sleep in his office. Their secretaries will cancel everything they have because they call it fast time and slow time. You may have heard that expression.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the what they call the golden hour, which is if like the first hour and then the first 24 hours after a murder is discovered, because the longer time goes on, the more things like, you know, you take the initial crime scene where the body's discovered, if it's out in the open, the longer that it's left, the more the elements, wild animals, whatever, will take away the evidence. And so that those first sort of hours after discovery are absolutely crucial.
And I love the scenes with Rachel, too. I love, you know, what I don't want to give anything away, but I just love... You know, as we see her day by day, hour by hour, see what happens to her. I like the way he did that. And, of course, going back and forth in time is really interesting, too. We get to see Roy investigating both times, which is really interesting.
Thanks. Yeah, I've tried to sort of show the difference between 12 years ago and now in terms of police investigation techniques and attitudes towards rape, which is so different now to what it was.
And I wonder, is each successive book harder to write for you, or do you find you're getting into the rhythm of it and each one's, is it becoming easier?
It's both in a sense. It's easier in the sense that I've got more and more and more with each book into the lives of the characters, But it's harder in the sense that I have this feeling that I don't want to fall into the trap of writing the same book over and over and over.
No, absolutely not. That would be boring.
Yeah. And I feel that, you know, I need to raise the bar with each book. So it's harder in that sense as to, you know, what made the last book work.
It's kind of like that limbo stick where you keep raising it and it's harder to jump over, you know?
Yeah.
You gotta.
Exactly.
And each time it gets higher and higher and higher until you get to the point where, well, what do I do now? How do I make the next book? Because people are very big on that. I mean, I talk to customers that come into the store and they'll say, well, I love that one, but I didn't like this one as much. I mean, as a writer, how do you feel when you hear something like that? If somebody says to you, well, I love Dead Like You, but I didn't like the last one. How do you feel?
I take big notice of what readers say. You know, you're always going to get one who maybe doesn't like something for whatever reason, but if two or three start saying the same thing, then I think you're nuts if you don't listen. I read my Amazon reviews. I get, you know, a massive amount of fan emails. And I read them all, and I reply to them all, but I listen to what they say, and if three or four or five readers all start saying the same thing, and think, okay, you know, they've got a point, I have to address that.
Right. It's hard. I mean, you think about books, you think, when the reader only has so much attention. When the reader picks up a book, they're only going to give it so much of a chance, and then they're going to give up. If they don't like the book, if the book's slow or something it doesn't. And what I find it's interesting about readers is when I describe sometimes to a customer what a book's about, sometimes if the subject matter is not to their liking, they won't even read the book.
Yeah.
And it's really upsetting because, you know, I have to say to them, well, it's kind of intense and it's a little gory, and sometimes that turns off a reader right then and there.
It's very interesting you say that, because the second Roy Grace book, I had this kind of massive success with the first one with Dead Simple, and then the second one, I wrote about a subject which I'd been wanting to write about, which was snuff movies.
Wow.
Because I got, a long story short, but I was asked, this was going back about 20 years, by a police surgeon, if I would come and take a look at a piece of footage that Sussex police had seized in a raid, and would I look at this with my movie making hat on?
Wow.
Rather than my author hat. And I went around to the police headquarters, and I was sat in a room, and they put this video on, and it was a 13-year-old girl being stabbed to death on a cross.
Wow.
And they said, do you think this girl is acting, or is this real? And I said, well, you know, she's acting, she's won an Oscar, because, you know, she's real, this is real. And I said, what is this? And they said, it's a piece of film that we seized, it was made in Russia, and it's being made for a market for people who will actually pay big money to see movies of people actually being killed.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah, and I wrote this novel about this, and I had one of the characters in it had a previous track record as a kind of paedophile. And, you know, I discovered there were people who wouldn't read a book that had anything to do with what they call kiddie fiddling.
Hmm. Yes.
Like it was a complete taboo. You know, they weren't, and I was saying, actually, the book is not about that, but...
That's what you remember, though, when you read it. That's what you're going to remember, the parts that were unsettling.
Yeah. So you have, in a sense, you know, I think, to be aware of where the boundaries are.
Right.
One of the boundaries I learned years ago was you can kill as many people as you want, but don't ever harm an animal. That will turn people off.
Right. Exactly. I remember there was a local... I think this guy was a treasurer of some company, and he was on the afternoon news, and he was making... he was turning himself in, and nobody knew this, but he had a gun, and he ended up shooting himself. Well, the footage got onto the afternoon news in all its detail, and I had to turn away before I saw it, because I knew if I looked at it, I would never forget it for the rest of my life. It's a horrifying... And then it ended up being shown on the afternoon news, live, with unedited.
My God.
And, you know, it caused a big stink. Those people were, but at the same time, people were fascinated by it too. Which is kind of sick when you think about it, but there is a fascination with blood and gore, despite the fact that it might make you sick to your stomach. There is something fascinating about it to a lot of people.
Yeah, I have this theory that part of the reason that people love reading crime novels is that we're all driven by our genes and by our survival genes. And I think, to some extent, it's the same reason why people rubberneck at bad road accidents, and that you look at a bad crash. And I don't think you're looking at it to think, oh, well, I hope I'm going to see some really nasty body. I think you tend to look at it to think, well, how did that happen? How do I avoid that happening to me? And I think with crime novels, very much the same applies. I think a lot of people read a crime novel. Okay, they're reading it at one level just to get the thrill of reading it, but I think there is a stronger subtext to it, which is they're reading it to think, okay, that happened to that victim. What can I learn from this book to make sure that never is going to happen to me?
How much of your free time is spent reading other people's books, or can you do that while you're writing a book?
When I'm actually writing, I tend to read only nonfiction because it's very easy to get picked up by somebody else, pick up somebody else's style.
Right.
But I binge read in between novels, so I read a lot in my own category, in my own genre, and out of it, I read, you know, literary fiction. I'll read something like Jonathan Franzen or.
There's an author. His name is, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. His last name is McFadden. Cody McFadden is his name. Writes the most intense crime thrillers I've ever read in my life. The most.
I read one actually, which was.
And they're unforgettable. And he goes to the very end of the spectrum. I mean, you'll read everything in his books. He doesn't edit anything out. I mean, it's just all there, all in all its detail. But he's a fantastic writer, and he's got the characters down to a T. You just feel like you know all these characters, and it's just amazing. But the gore is there, and the psychological stuff is out of this world. And yet, I mean, he's just a wonderful writer. But, you know, how much can you take? That's the question.
Yeah.
And how much are you going to remember?
Reality.
I mean, his second book, to this day, I still get shivers when I think about what it was about and how it affected me after I was done. That's saying a lot for a writer when a book affects you that much. I just remember staring at it after I was done and thinking, oh, my goodness, I don't think I could read that. Two of those in a row.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
A few books have had that effect on me. I remember years ago reading The Exorcist. And I was in this hotel room in Switzerland, and I had to actually put it down about 1 o'clock in the morning and start reading David Niven's The Moon's a Balloon just to have it cheerful, to get rid of this sense of something watching me in this room.
The Exorcist is I can't watch the movie because I literally feel like I'm living it right then and there. It's too upsetting for me.
Watch the movie, Dave, and read the book, because that is even worse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it just leaves it all to your imagination.
It makes you wonder what these writers are like in their mind. What do they think about that they can write this stuff? I mean, Thomas Harris, the same thing. How can he write those sick books?
But yeah, I mean, I think Silence of the Lambs was and is still probably the great kind of crossover crime horror novel,
and the cat with a totally memorable character. And the amazing thing is, he can make us feel bad. He can make us sympathize with Hannibal in a way.
Yeah, I know, that's right. It's like two strands of evil. It's kind of good versus bad, and bad versus evil with Hannibal and the Skinner.
Right.
There's another book that's like that, which is R11, the Rosemary's Baby.
Ah, R11, yes. I've read some of his.
If you ever read Rosemary's Baby, it's got that same quality to it.
Huh.
Which is kind of interesting saying that, because that was a couple who move into the apartment, which was based on the Dakota. It's kind of weird saying that on John Lennon's 30th anniversary.
Oh, the Dakota, yes, yes indeed. But your books are much more, I mean, they're not gory at all. In fact, there's not a gory scene in this whole book that I've there's upsetting scenes, but nothing that's going to stay with you forever. But you ratchet up the suspense really well. And I enjoy that. I enjoy your sentence. Your sentence structure to me is very beautiful.
Thank you very much, sir.
I like that. And this is the type of book where you just sit and you turn the pages, and before you know it, you're 300-400 pages in, and you're almost devouring the book. in essence, and that's such a wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's the way it feels, and whoever reads it's going to feel the same way. I guarantee it. It's been an absolute delight to have you. We've just about run out of time. I wish I had more time to talk to you.
David, thank you. It's a delight to talk to you, and I'm just so thrilled.
Yeah, can you give us real quickly the title of the next book so people can watch out for it?
Yeah, it's called Dead Man's Grip.
That's a good title.
It actually involves the New York Mafia, and it's basically the son of the godfather of the New York Mafia gets killed in an accident in England.
So we can actually look forward to that at the same time next year, probably?
Yeah.
Wonderful. It's been a delight. We've been talking to Peter James. His new book's called Dead Like You. It's out from St. Martin's Minotaur. It's available in all your bookstores. It's a beautiful cover and just a really intense book, and I hope you all get to enjoy it. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.